This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You are listening to Enterprise Biz Bytes on BFM 89.9. I'm Christine Wong, and joining me in the studio today is
Lily Chai.
And today we are talking about the low skills, low wage trap. What on earth does that all mean, and how are our youth slipping into it? We will be speaking to Calvin Cheung, senior analyst at the Institute of Strategic and International Studies, Malaysia. But if you would also like to be part of the conversation, of course, we are on Twitter at BFM Radio and on WhatsApp 018-789-8899. So what even is the low skills, low wage trap? Well, there are a few things to understand about it. First of all, low-skill workers are limited in terms of their employment options. So a strong case for this would be SPM graduates who do not continue on with their higher education. This severely limits their options to entry-level jobs, even part-time employment, and physically demanding professions. And jobs within this category are often categorized within the low-wage category as well. Now, according to the 2020 Statistics Department's report on salaries and wages, low-skilled jobs, quote-unquote, such as elementary occupations, service and sales workers, craft and trade workers, plant and machine operators, they earn median wages of between 1,400 ringgit to 1,900 ringgit in 2019, obviously before the minimum wage increase to 1,500 ringgit. But this was compared against a national median of roughly 2,400 ringgit.
So what does the word trap mean in low wage trap? So this word is used to define a lack of upward mobility for these workers, as they lack the capability and knowledge to work on complex work, further limiting their career progression. And an example for this would be where an F&B server takes on a managerial role and finds it very challenging due to the lack of the right skill sets required to take on an extra layer of responsibility. And a report by the Harvard Business School revealed some insights into the low skills, low wage trap. So despite working long hours, low wage workers struggle to escape poverty. And majority of these workers are trapped in entry-level positions, even after years of working experience. And employers do not invest or underinvest when it comes to skills training and raising workers' productivity. And this can contribute to low skills, low-wage workers feeling stuck and seeing no avenue to move upwards in their careers.
Mm-hmm. So given that individuals without higher education are most at risk of falling into this trap, it is important naturally to increase the level of educational attainment for the future workforce. So the proportion of the Malaysian workforce with a diploma or a degree did increase from roughly 25% back in 2010 to roughly 33% in 2020. Those with an SPM certificate and below saw a drop from roughly 69% to 60% within the same period. And safe to say that the gig economy and the pandemic have also changed the narrative a little bit as well. For example, working as a Grab driver can allow a low-skilled worker to move up the income bracket quite significantly. And also not to mention that working towards a certificate for higher education involves many costs, not just from the financial perspective.
Right, so there is also the substantial opportunity costs, which forgoes current income for higher future income. So individuals from poorer households cannot afford such costs, so they enter the workforce immediately after SPM. So a survey conducted by the Statistics Department revealed that roughly 70% of Malaysian youth chose to enter the workforce immediately after SPM. And two of the most common career paths being gig workers or as social media influencers, as they do not see the value in continuing their studies in tertiary education. And if the report correctly captures the sentiments among our youths, Malaysia's human capital might deteriorate moving forward.
Mm. So looking at this from the youth standpoint, right? I mean, there is a definite draw factor from the gig economy, as it does offer income potential that is higher than, honestly, even fresh graduates. Mm. And, you know, it pays well and it might not require extensive training. But I think the question here with that is it a long-term career option, right? I mean, this discussion on the nature of, you know, quote-unquote low-skilled labor versus the gig economy versus higher education needs to be approached from multiple facets, right? We need to take a look at career progression, company benefits, income stability, and social social safety needs as well. And in an article on Free Malaysia Today, there was a sort of a thought experiment that indicated some important points when it comes to earning potential. In the short-term view, of course, you know, gig economy workers might consistently outperform non-gig economy workers in cumulative annual income, right? But if we look long-term, individuals who progress into higher education will catch up with gig economy workers in time when it comes to earning potential, even if they enter the workforce later due to career progression. And then, however, both would still have a higher income potential compared to an SPM graduate in other low-skilled industries who would be struggling due to the cost of living in Malaysia.
So investing into human capital has been proven to enhance economic development and standard of living. Education enables opportunities and upward economic mobility, and it remains the critical ingredient in escaping poverty. In an OECD's report titled Education at a Glance 2019, individuals with a bachelor's degree, nearly 45% more than their counterparts with only an upper secondary education. So this wage disparity increases to 90% for individuals with a master's degree or doctorate. And higher levels of education can lead to better opportunities within high-paying careers. Workers without the education and skill sets would be caught in the low skills, low wage trap.
And even though the long-term benefits of higher education are proven, many poor households are simply unable to afford it. And this creates that poverty loop where low-income households remain poor because they're not able to send their children to tertiary education, right? And this is where public provision for education support becomes important in enhancing human capital, raising national income, and addressing poverty. Fair to say that our education system needs to be revamped to accommodate current trends and development. Benjamin Franklin said it best, an investment in knowledge pays the best interest. Now, I think for us here in the studio, it's safe to say that we do, we have to acknowledge, first of all, the privilege that we have both had in being able to pursue tertiary education for me as well internationally. So that is one element. And definitely, you know, with the question of do we feel that it's opened up opportunities for us in the working world, I would honestly say so, but not just because of the education itself. I mean, personally speaking, I would say that it's not just the academic institution, but it's also the resources that you're exposed to. It's the kind of culture, opening up your mind, your worldview, that sort of thing as well, right? I mean, safe to say, without my tertiary educational background, I wouldn't be doing radio. That's how I got exposed to, you know, being in radio in the first place, right? I mean, what do you think about that?
I do think tertiary education is important, but again, we go back to the word of privilege, right? But then we do have avenues, you know, giving the people from the poor a more education in terms of like the avenues, they are there, but the problem is why aren't we utilizing and optimizing it fully? And 70% of youth not wanting to pursue tertiary education, it is a worrying and a concerning issue, right?
Yeah, and I think also there does need to be a bit more awareness brought to the different routes SPM or post high school that people can take that, you know, either are tertiary education or are alternative forms of it. I mean, we talk, we've spoken on BizBytes before about the DeVet industry, as a potential alternative. Because, I mean, it can't just be, you know, university or being a social media influencer / grab driver. There has to be other things. And I think there needs to be that conversation as well. And also, you know, the financial barrier is definitely a massive, massive obstacle in the way of all of this. So that needs to be reviewed and definitely taken a look at as well. Also, you know, if you are listening and you have thoughts to share with us on this topic, of course, reach out Twitter at BFM Radio and WhatsApp 018-789-8899. It is, however, time for a few messages. But after that, we will be joined by Calvin Cheng, Senior Analyst at the Institute of Strategic and International Studies, Malaysia, to understand this issue deeper and also taking a look at what we need to be doing to address this. So do stay tuned. Here's Rehab by Amy Winehouse on BFM 89.9.
Bright, formidable media. BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're tuned in to Enterprise Biz Bites on BFM 89.9. I'm Christine Wong and I'm joined by
Lily Chai.
And today we are talking about the low skill, low wage trap. Why our youths keep falling into it. And if you would like to get in touch with us about this topic, we are on Twitter at BFM Radio and on WhatsApp 018-789-8899. On the line with us, we have Calvin Cheng, Senior Analyst at the Institute of Strategic and International Studies, Malaysia, in order to understand this issue deeper. Thanks, Calvin, for joining us on the show today. Now, as we mentioned before the break, an article on Free Malaysia Today recently mentioned a growing concern that young people are trapped in low-skill, low-wage jobs. Can you shed some light on the situation?
Firstly, it's the low-skilled nature of the jobs, which are technically it's more semi-skilled, but yeah, it's a skilled nature of the job. And then it's the low wages. Secondly, it's the low wages related to the job, right? And this is associated with lower skill, but also a problem generally as well. And then the third component is trap, right? Which is the lack of ability to move towards a good job or a better job. So the first thing is low skill. So I'm guessing you mean individuals who are overeducated or overtrained for the job they have, in which case we're talking about technically skill-related underemployment, which is technically defined by the Department of Statistics as people who have a tertiary education, but who work in low or semi-skilled jobs. So they're not working in high-skilled jobs. And this has always been a problem even before the pandemic, and it's true across countries as well. I know South Korea and Japan have their own issues with this. And skill-related underemployment for young people have always been much, much higher than for older workers, even before the pandemic in 2019. But of course, the pandemic has made this worse for the most part. And overall, the pandemic has made underemployment worse in general, not just skill-related. So that's the skill part. Then there's the wage issue, right? So low wage. So this is part of a larger issue. And that has roots in how we value labor and how we value work in this country. So traditionally, worker bargaining power has been very low in Malaysia. And this is a deliberate policy choice to keep costs and in wages low, to keep businesses, employers happy and attract foreign investment. But, as we become more increasingly developed, this is increasingly no longer tenable. So now the focus is on raising labor standards and raising wages and raising the welfare of workers, right? And the third thing is mobility. So that's the sort of the trap part, right? So that's related to the availability of good jobs in the first place. And on the demand side, most jobs created in Malaysia are semi-skilled. They're not high skilled, and then also relates on the supply side to skills mismatches and then other issues with mobility, like including geographic and sectoral mobility. One more thing is there are other things that go beyond underemployment, right? So there are other out labor outcomes that are worse than being trapped in a low skilled, low wage job. Going back to your question, firstly is you can't be underemployed if you don't have a job. Right. So we know that the employment outcomes of young people have deteriorated very strongly during the pandemic. Employment to population ratios for young people, particularly young women, have been impacted greatly and have not recovered to pre-pandemic levels. And then there's a statistic called NEET rate, which is the share of youth not in employment, education or training. And that has increased strongly in 2020. So there are other fates in the labor market that are worse than unemployment, but largely what I mean to say is a longer-term issue.
Hmm. All right, Calvin, could you expand on the worker wages bargaining power not being where they are at the moment? Why isn't it as strong as where we'd like them to be?
This has roots in British colonialism, in which we have deliberately and systematically, as a policy choice, choose to reduce worker bargaining power in terms of disallowing trade unions, disallowing workers to collectively organize. And this eventually in the 80s has roots in neoliberalism as well. So it's a deliberate policy choice to keep sort of costs low and wages low, to keep businesses and employers happy, to attract foreign investment. And this is a sort of a longer term issue that we are only now beginning to grapple with. And we've seen over the past couple of years more movement on the front of increasing labor standards and increasing minimum wages, increasing the way in which we value work in this country.
Definitely. Now, before we discuss solutions, we do want to explore a little bit more about the reason why this is happening. What are some factors that have led to this issue being where it is now for Malaysia?
So I like to think of it in two components. One of it is the labor demand side, so which is the type of jobs that are available. So the Malaysian economy tends to create more semi-skilled jobs than any other kind. So more semi-skilled jobs than both high-skilled jobs and low-skilled jobs. And this is based on the job creation data that we have currently. So then, of course, when tertiary graduates, university graduates move into these semi-skilled jobs, they are then automatically counted as being underemployed or skill-related underemployed. Because, you know, recall the definition of skill-related underemployment is someone who has tertiary education but is not working in a high-skilled job. So one part of it is just the sort of makeup of how jobs, the types of jobs that are created in Malaysia. And this is related, of course, to labor standards as well. So like I mentioned, overall, we've traditionally kept labor standards on the low side. Worker bargaining power is low and wages have been kept low, sort of to appease businesses. So this tends to create a sort of environment of a what some people call low road or low wage employment opportunities. Right, so that's on the labor demand side. Then on the labor supply side, which is to do with the workforce characteristics itself, and this issues in this arena include, you know, often cited issues like skills mismatches between graduates and workers and industry demand, and the issue of skills deficits. So we have some survey evidence that local graduates lack certain soft skills related to communication and language, but of course this again also interacts with the sort of low road employment environment in which their employers are sort of unwilling traditionally in the past to invest in sufficient on-the-job training for prospective hires. And instead, they're looking towards a more of a shorter horizons, you know, lower cost, you know, plug-and-play kind of workers. And also on the labor supply side, it's just related to education, right? So in this field, people think about the failure of the TVET system. So that's a technical vocational education and training. TVET system to increase, enrollment of TVET trainees to show young people that this is a viable career choice. So TVET jobs are high skill jobs. You know, many people forget that. And there's many missed opportunities with TVET in Malaysia. And I have a colleague in ISIS Malaysia who works on this issue.
Right. Speaking of this, do you think we as a society are becoming more aware of youths being trapped in this low-skilled, low-wage cycle? And if yes, are we addressing this issue enough?
It's not really a new issue. So much has been said about this. And this has been globally a pressing issue, at least since the last decade, from the last global financial crisis. And this is a common issue across developed and developing countries. And in Malaysia, I think policymakers have been aware of this issue for at least the last few years before the pandemic. So, the creation of the graduate tracer study in the Ministry of Higher Education, we had a slew of work-related policies like Malaysia at Work, you know, sometime in 2019, and then many more that are similar. So there's some awareness there, but the pandemic has, you know, definitely made this more clear, more salient. And as to whether, going back to your question, as to whether we're doing enough, the short answer is always going to be, you know, if the issue still exists, then of course, you know, we're not doing enough. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Now, again, it's time to take a short break for some messages as well, but do stay on the line with us. We're speaking to Calvin Cheng, Senior Analyst at the Institute of Strategic and International Studies Malaysia, about the low-skill, low-wage trap. Ironically, we have Working for a Living here by Huey Lewis and the News on BFM 89.9.
Business-filled minds, BFM 89.9.
This is Enterprise Biz Bytes. I'm Christine Wong and I'm in the studio with
Lily Chai.
And today we are talking about the low skill, low wage trap and how our youths are being trapped in it. If you would like to take part in the conversation, we are on Twitter at BFM Radio and on WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Now we do have on the line with us today, Calvin Cheng, Senior Analyst at the Institute of Strategic and International Studies Malaysia. Now, Calvin, picking our conversation back up, realistically, what policies should Malaysia be looking at if we want to tackle this issue?
So I'm currently working on a sort of a publication on this. And in my sort of view, there are two broad overarching goals. So the first is building resilience to shocks. we know from the pandemic and from other past crises in Malaysia that the labor market outcomes of vulnerable groups, and this is young people, lower skilled or less educated workers, you know, we know that the labor outcomes of these groups are very strongly affected by changes in aggregate demand or rather growth shocks, right? So there's no use of building up labor outcomes of young workers if every crisis they get, you know, knocked backwards again, which is why we need to build resilience in these shocks, right? And this includes improving the social safety net, increasing the amount of protection that's available, and more importantly, broadening coverage of existing protections across different types of workers. And one key thing is also to strengthen sort of automatic stabilizers, so automatic responses. So what this means is to make our safety nets more responsive to shocks without waiting for policymakers to legislate or to announce stimulus packages during times of crises or times of growth shocks, as we've seen during the pandemic. So that's the first thing, is building resilience. And the second thing, what I call creating opportunity. This has broadly two components. One of it is the active labor market policy side. So we have some active labor market policy components in our employment insurance system, or EIS. But of course, the recommendation is to strengthen this further. So what I'm talking about is things like job search and matching, which we have some components, but you know, it could be strengthened. Things like skills training, and this needs to be demand and industry driven. And like I mentioned before, TVET plays a big role in skills training as well. And sort of creating the ability of workers to move across regions in terms of geographical region as well as sectors. So allowing workers to move the opportunity to move towards better jobs. So that's on the active labor market side. And on the sort of supply side is creating a good jobs environment, or rather encouraging what some people call high road employment. So we know that the market tends to undersupply good jobs, and this is a common finding. So you know, we can attract high quality FDI, and we should, but FDI alone is insufficient to create good jobs, right? So in some ways, we need to remove our fixation or rather dependence on foreign multinationals to provide good jobs. So this means that increasing domestic labor standards, like I mentioned, you know, encouraging local firms to invest in sort of longer term high road employment. And there are many ways to do this, you know, this carrot and stick approaches. One way to do it organically is to increase labor standards and strengthen labor market institutions, you know, enforcing labor violations, just sort of providing a strong signal that we are moving towards that direction. And the other things related to this as well is supporting the creation of domestic firms. So increasing the number of local businesses employers that are created each year. So local SMEs employ about roughly half of all workers in Malaysia. And often these are pathways towards good jobs. So related to that as well is increasing the size of local firms. So I think we tend to focus a lot on SMEs, on micro enterprises. But in my opinion, we also need to focus on large firms, or rather at least building up the size of our medium firms to become large firms, because no country has succeeded without developing, you know, a locally owned, large, innovative and competitive firm. And of course, there are many ways to do this, but these are often sources of good jobs for young people.
And this year, the minimum wage for Malaysia has adjusted to 1,500 ringgit. Has this adjustment of minimum wage helped in any way?
In terms of specifically the minimum wage for Malaysia, I can't say for sure just because I haven't run any sort of causal evaluations on the minimum wage specifically. But more generally, based on evidence, international evidence, and what we know, it helps, of course, in my opinion. There are a lot of issues, of course, with enforcement. And I think it should be also regionally adjusted for different regions, just because the disparities in regional development in Malaysia are very, very large. And as such, wages are very high across, very highly different across different regions in Malaysia. But overall, based on international evidence, it does help in terms of pushing the wages at the lower end of the wage distribution up. So it sort of has cascading effects on the bottom end of the wage distribution in terms of wage growth. And we also have evidence that the disemployment effects are quite low, at least at this level. So I think more importantly, it sets the tone for businesses and more generally in that we're now moving towards an equilibrium where it's more of a high labor standards, you know, higher quality, and we're not trying to compete on sort of, you know, low costs.
Right. And, you know, I guess final question for you, Calvin. The gig economy has provided an avenue for low-skilled workers to earn a living, especially during the pandemic. However, Gig work is perceived as having a limited career progression. Do you see the numbers of youth workers growing within the gig economy? And is it a symptom towards larger problems?
I think that the number of young workers in the gig economy reflects both the increasing demand for services provided by the gig economy, as well as the relative attractiveness of gig work, both in terms of flexibility as well as in potential wages. And this is especially true for non-tertiary educated individuals or lower skilled individuals, right? So I think this is in itself, it's not really a symptom of a larger problem, in the sense that it's just technological change and it's responding to demand for gig workers and services provided by gig workers. The issue though is that how the emergence of gig work, or rather non-standard work more generally, creates sort of exclusion for some workers in terms of social protection, in terms of social safety nets. And we've seen this become a very large issue in recent months, especially during the pandemic, especially during the pandemic and even before. So I think that in itself, it's not really a symptom of a larger problem, but there are ways to regulate it to sort of ensure the welfare of gig workers by and large.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Calvin, for those insights. That was Calvin Cheng, Senior Analyst at the Institute of Strategic and International Studies, Malaysia. And that brings us to about the end of the show. But do not go anywhere. Coming up after the 1 p.m. news bulletin is, of course, the Breakfast Grill replay. Even with the challenges posed by the COVID-19 pandemic, Islamic financing continues with a healthy growth of 8.2% in 2021, and it now constitutes around 41% of the total banking sector's loans. Maybank Islamic is the largest Islamic bank in ASEAN and one of the top five in the world in terms of assets. CEO Dato Rafiq Merican shares with The Breakfast Grill their role in turning Malaysia into the world's leading global Islamic finance hub, as well as the impact of rising interest rates and the rise of digital banks in Malaysia. On behalf of myself, Christine Wong, and my colleague Lily Chai, this has been Express Biz Bytes on BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.